Hello, I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence, and this is Sibylline Insights. Please do remember to like and subscribe. On this week's episode, Alexander Lord will be taking us through events in France. We'll be joined by Riccardo Cucciani to talk about Xi Jinping's recent visit to Russia, and Leila Guest will discuss the recent ICC arrest warrant placed on Vladimir Putin. So, Alex, great to welcome you to the podcast. Many of our listeners would have been following the recent unrest in France as a result of the pension reform bill. But before we come on to recent developments, can you just put us in the picture as to the context of this bill?
Yeah, so the pension reform bill has been very much a flagship policy of the Macron presidency. And of course, Macron previously tried to push this through before the pandemic in his first term. And of course, now that he's in his second term, time is running out, but But Macron is definitely doubling down as for this as a priority for his administration. Overall, the premise of the reform is to increase the pension age from 62 to 64. And the government have prefaced this around the long-term viability of the pension budget. It's already making up some 14% of French GDP, and that's likely to grow in the future. So that's the argument. But of course, there is significant backlash and resistance to this, which we're seeing unfold at the moment, particularly following Macron's decision to use constitutional mechanisms to get around Parliament and to push this law through.
And are there specific groups that are reacting to this, politically driven groups, unions, etc., or has this writ large not gone down that well in French society?
I think both. So the kernel of the resistance are organised protests by the unions. And the unions have, of course, retained a significant influence across French society for many decades, and that's not going to end anytime soon. The strong unions, they are, of course, at the moment pretty united on this particular issue. So that's what we're seeing at the moment, and the unions are committing to continue with the protests, continuing with this resistance, in order for them to force a government U-turn. Ultimately, Macron has placed a significant amount of his own political capital behind this reform, and he's been on the television doubling down on this message. So a U-turn will be very politically difficult for Macron, and I think at this stage unlikely. So that's, I think, one of the principal reasons why we're likely to see these protests continue at least over the next month, if not beyond. But there are also the less organised elements, which tend to make up a larger proportion of the overall demographics involved in the protests. And these are more spontaneous protests every evening, which we're seeing this week at the moment. So yeah, it's both organised and unorganised, a bit more spontaneous. And that's I think, going to be the dynamics which we're going to see going forward.
So you said politically it's going to be difficult for Macron to roll back on this. And as such, these protests are going to continue. I mean, before we go into the implications, how long are they going to continue for? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel or any off-ramp?
Well, I think the key thing in the short term is the fact that the Constitutional Court will have to make a decision on whether this the invocation of certain articles within the Constitution is approved. So at the moment, there's no end in sight to that. Of course, if they reject it, then that's difficult for Macron and may well take some of the wind out of the sails of the protests. But of course, if they approve it, then this is something that could likely go on for a while. Like I said, the unions are committing to a fairly long fight for this.
So in terms of implications then, I mean, are there any specific targets? We've seen recent developments as we're recording this. Overnight, the targeting of government buildings, there's obviously a huge bystander risk. Can you just go over some of the implications for our clients and those operating in the region in terms of where these are taking place, what they're targeting, and who and what might be affected?
Absolutely. Obviously, when we've seen similar dynamics in play in France before, and there is always a scope for escalation. By and large, these protests are peaceful, but of course, clashes, the potential for violence is definitely there. And indeed, just last night, relative to time of recording, we saw the Bordeaux town hall set on fire. And indeed, I think one of the biggest indicators of how credible this threat is that His Majesty the King's state visit to France has actually been postponed. That was just a couple of minutes ago ahead of this recording. That, I think, does say how credible this is and how security protocols are being in place now that this could well escalate further. I think one of the key issues for businesses on the ground in particular will be whether radical elements on the extreme will start to engage with the protests on a more meaningful level, particularly Black Bloc, an anarchist group which has, in previous previous periods of tension, played a fairly large role in facilitating and provoking clashes with security forces. Of course, that also carries risks of arson. Shop fronts will be at particular risk during particularly tense protests. And of course, Paris will be the epicenter, as it always is, given it's the capital, Île-de-France region more broadly. But again, Bordeaux, Lyon, Marseille, other places as well. We're also, of course, seeing knock-on impacts in terms of petrol availability and various other second and third order impacts, which I think will furthermore reinforce anger amongst the population that this is impacting their lives.
So ongoing and an uncertain risk environment, and something I know we've been keeping a close eye on. I believe your desk are issuing another situation update brief for our clients in the near future. And I think that, I guess, the key message is then just keep your ear to the ground, keep looking at the reporting, and I'm sure we'll have you again on the podcast to update. But for now, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Ricardo, great to welcome you back to the podcast. A really hot topic at the minute is Xi's visit to Russia, of course, and we've been getting many requests for information from our clients on this. So can you just put us in the picture, from what we know, you know, what was discussed, what was China looking for, and what did they get from this visit?
Sure. So Xi Jinping visited Russia this Monday until Wednesday, between the 20th and 22nd of March. There were high expectations from both sides, and it was expected that a peace plan regarding Ukraine was going to be discussed, but that seems like it was not the case. It appears that the visit was more about bolstering Chinese diplomatic support for Russia, as well as a continuation of China's recent diplomatic and charm offensive.
So you say there's a peace plan discussed before this, and I know previously it was suggested that Xi might actually visit Zelensky as well, but that didn't happen, did it? He just visited Russia.
Correct. That did not happen. There were expectations that there was going to be a call between Xi Jinping and Zelensky, but that also has not occurred yet. It is now expected that it may occur in the next few days or weeks, but that still remains to be confirmed. Even when it will occur, I remain doubtful that a sustainable peace plan could be implemented. China now appears as to having doubled down on its support for Russia, at least that's how it's going to be perceived. So I would say it's improbable now to expect China being a sustainable peace broker and somebody that basically the West could trust.
Of course, because recently we've obviously seen China broker the Iranian-Saudi rapprochement. So, you know, how does that square China's support for Russia in the conflict, its ostensible support, and seemingly its desire on the world stage to appear as a broker for peace? How have they managed to square that circle, or are they not? Is this simply an empty gesture?
I wouldn't say it's an empty gesture. I think it's also incorrect to have expected the same results as it occurred between Saudi Arabia and Iran with regards to Russia. The context is completely different. There is an active war going on, and China is perceived as to backing the bad guy in this context, at least is how the West sees it. And also China does not wish to be seen as supporting the losing side, because that's what's happening in the battlefield at the moment. There's also the issue of possible, or at least feared, Chinese defense procurement towards Russia, which the West still maintains. It is possible, and it has been discussed. There has been some evidence that some weapons were transferred, but there still lacks evidence that the Chinese state was the one actively providing weapons to the Russian armed forces.
So in summary, would you say this was more a routine visit that didn't quite meet expectations? And we'll talk to Leila in a moment about the Russian perspective, and that despite, you know, China's outward appearance as a broker in this, their support for Russia will remain resolute and strong, but not escalate to new levels that we've not seen thus far.
That's correct. I wouldn't characterize it as a routine visit. I think it was one that was special in many senses, and one that was very much needed for both Russia and China. And yes, China did have to play very carefully to not double down too much in support for Russia and actively coming out as essentially supporting Russia's military efforts in Ukraine, which still refrains to do so. But it has increased a certain extent its diplomatic support for Russia in general, and they also strengthened bilateral economic ties. There's also a downside to this growing, deepening relations, at least from the perspective of Russia, in that there are now perceptions that China is the bigger player in the bilateral relationship, and there are expectations that Russia may become in the future somewhat of a vassal state to China.
So the cynic could see this as China being opportunist, looking at the economic benefits of the change in dynamic between the two and looking to shore that up, or you could say exploit it?
To a certain extent, yes. And in fact, the worst series of economic and trade agreements that were signed, mostly with regards to energy exports. And there were also agreements to be made that Chinese firms will essentially filled the gap left by Western firms in Russia.
Well, really interesting. It's getting a lot of traction, I know, in the media, and I know we're getting a lot of requests on the back of this meeting. I look forward to discussing it again, but for now, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So Leila, great to welcome you back on the podcast for a second consecutive week. We've just heard Ricardo talking about Xi's visit to Russia. We're talking about expectations. Can you give us an idea of what maybe Putin was expecting from this meeting?
Sure, Gareth. Thank you for inviting me back on. I believe Putin was probably expecting a lot of collaboration between Russia and China in multiple spheres, such as trade, defense, economics, and whilst they did pledge more mutual military drills and patrols and various other bilateral cooperation, I think much was left to be desired from that meeting. I think what actually happened, from what we can see, is that this meeting has actually cemented Russia's role as China's junior partner in this, and it did demonstrate the asymmetry of their relations. So whilst they say they have a no limits partnership, which was signed in February last year, we can actually see there are limits, and those limits are mostly for Beijing.
So in a nutshell, Putin didn't quite get what he was after in this. I mean, was this inevitable? Was this an inevitable outcome?
Well, we can't determine exactly what Putin would have wanted in this, but you know, China has continued to stress, and Russia as well, but China is very, very much insistent that this is a no alliance, no confrontation, and this relationship does not target any third parties. But what Putin did get from this meeting, and Xi as well, it was really an opportunity for the two to showcase that they really want to drive this multipolar world order where the US is not the dominant force. They really want it to be a new age of Russia and China, you know, coming and playing a more active role on the world stage, as opposed to it being, you know, a US-dominated world.
That's really interesting. So in essence, then, from the Russian point of view, no firm military progress made as a result of the meeting. Do you think this meeting has changed Putin's calculus in terms of the military progress of the war, or do you think this visit doesn't really change anything, you know, on the front lines?
Well, I would argue that China, being very risk averse, and I'm pretty sure that Russia is very much aware of this, it's quite clear to see. I don't think it would have changed it in that respect. I think that this was a good diplomatic cover, which Putin needed, this meeting currently. And we don't know what's going on behind closed doors in those meetings in the Kremlin. But from what we see, China does remain quite resolute to not provide this aid, lethal aid, to be used in Ukraine, and continue to say, you know, we're impartial. How much of that, you know, is really impartial is, well, remains to sort of be contested. But I would say China remains quite strong on the fact that it does not want to, at a state level, give this aid. So that's just what we've seen.
So a shoring up of the diplomatic alliance, the anti-West and the anti-US alliance, really, some gains maybe for China and assurance as a senior partner, and nothing really gained for Russia. Very interesting. We're going to move on now, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because recently we've seen the ICC, International Criminal Court, indict, if that's the right language, Putin, and put a warrant out for his arrest. Now we'll get on to some of the deeper implications and some of the most recent rhetoric from his administration. But can you just outline for what he's been, you know, indicted, what are the charges against Putin at this stage?
Yeah, sure. So last Friday, that was the 17th of March, the ICC issued an arrest warrant against Vladimir Putin and Russia's Child Rights Commissioner, Maria Lvova-Belova. And essentially what these warrants are for is for the unlawful deportation of Ukrainian children to Russia. So Ukraine claims that more than 16,000 children have been deported to Russia. And while the majority of those have been located, I think just around 300 have been returned back to Ukraine. So there's also evidence to suggest that, so from a report published in February, that around 6,000 children at least have been sent to camps within Russian-occupied Crimea and Russia for the purpose of political re-education. Yes.
And that's essentially what the ICC has put a warrant out on him for. Mm-hmm. I mean, the question will be, will he be arrested? But before that, as we're recording it, I think in the last 24 hours, we've seen a former Russian president, mm-hmm. Medvedev, come out and essentially threaten countries that extradite or carry out this arrest on Putin, threatening, I think, specifically Germany, mm-hmm. amongst others. For those listeners who might be wondering what on earth this is, can you just briefly outline what Medvedev said and your assessment?
Sure, absolutely. So Dmitry Medvedev is Russia's former president, and essentially he's made quite a few hawkish remarks this week. There were at least two instances which I've seen. So the first is he threatened to actually bomb The Hague with a hypersonic missile. And yes, so this was not received very well by the ICC, of course. And then yesterday he threatened Germany. He said if Germany, for instance, were to, you know, arrest Putin, then missiles and all of Russia's assets would go into the Bundestag. So very, very hawkish rhetoric, which is designed to instill this fear to not carry out this warrant.
And, I mean, do you think, for example, if Germany did, or any other country, NATO or otherwise, did manage to arrest Putin on a visit, for example, not that he would currently visit Germany, I assess, but mm-hmm. do you think these threats would be carried out, or are, you know, is this rhetoric in a long line of just, as you say, hawkish, inflammatory rhetoric, which probably doesn't reflect Kremlin policy? What's your assessment?
I think it would be a very, very unprecedented thing for Russia to have one of its, well, as we know, there's only been three now sitting heads of states to have such a warrant. So this whole Putin's arrest warrant is very unprecedented anyway. And I think that could mean Russia takes unprecedented measures. Whether that means nukes, I remain skeptical of, but I believe upping the nuclear risk rhetoric is a massive way for the Kremlin to take control of the situation and give these threats, for example, especially against countries that are not as well equipped to deal with a nuclear threat.
So our baseline assessment of objective nuclear risk remains the same. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's highly unlikely, or remote, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
It's very, very low. But you assess that the rhetoric will match this action, and we'll probably see more of this in the future.
Yes, absolutely.
And on the subject of him actually being arrested, now, we've recently seen some countries come out who are signed up to the, you know, the Rome Treaty, saying that they probably won't arrest him if they come to visit. Of course, countries will be put in a bit of a dilemma. Mm-hmm. When, you know, they host summits, for example, of where Putin could be invited. essentially they're going to have to not invite him if they are going to stick by the treaty. So who are likely to arrest him, if anyone? Is he going to get arrested?
I would say at this moment, it's very, very, very unlikely that Putin will be handed over to The Hague. So it does definitely complicate his travel plans. He was due to visit South Africa for a BRICS summit, so Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, in August. And Pretoria has said, you know, we understand our obligations and the ICC arrest warrant. But what is interesting about this is the fact that former Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, he visited South Africa, and South Africa was given quite a lot of scrutiny for not arresting him.
So he had an arrest warrant on him too?
Yes. So the only two three sitting heads of states to have received such warrants was Gaddafi and al-Bashir. So that's the ranks now Putin's among.
But they didn't arrest... They didn't arrest this individual.
They did not arrest al-Bashir, no.
And of course, we've seen Hungary come out today as well, haven't we? And recently, state they might not abide by the treaty as well.
Yes, even though that they've signed it, they basically said that the treaty would have no basis in Hungarian law, which basically that does show that there are still deep policy disagreements within EU members. And this isn't, you know, unusual for Hungary. They have said some things before which would be considered as pro-Russian or Kremlin-friendly.
I mean, should Putin visit South Africa or Hungary or anywhere else and, you know, these countries fail to abide by their obligations, do you think there's much the international community can do about it? I realise this is very unprecedented here, but what's your opinion?
I think it would make sense for Putin to heed with caution, and especially to, say, European states that have sanctioned him. But that would mean that he would be very unlikely to go anyway. You know, with these anti-Russian sanctions, he might not want to travel to there anyway because, well, he can't. The other thing is Tajikistan, which is a close ally of Russia and a former Soviet Union country, that is an ICC member. And Putin traveled there last year, and he's gone multiple times in the last few years. So that would really put, say, Tajikistan in an awkward state as to, well, what can they do? And Russia could, being so close and a former Soviet Union member, that would present a lot of challenges for Tajikistan.
Really interesting. You know, I think the prevailing wind on this, as far as I've been able to see it, is that this is a token measure. But, you know, there are allies of Russia that have signed up to this treaty. And I think it'll be really interesting to see, in particular South Africa, as you say, and the Central Asian states, how that pans out from here on in. And I know we'll be watching it with great care. But for now, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast, Leila.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you to Alexander Lord, Ricardo Cucciani and Leila Guest. And of course, thanks to you for listening. Please do remember to like and subscribe, and we look forward to welcoming you to the next episode.